You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Anna Sale, in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Today, Oxford Dictionaries announces the word of 2013. It's a word I even cringe to say. Selfie.
My God.
We'll talk about the value of this latest form of photography and whether it's legitimate art, just narcissism, or something in between. Plus, later this hour, more about the twin bomb attacks on the Iranian embassy in Beirut. And we'll take a look at a new law in Missouri that changes the rules for lethal injection just before a man on death row is scheduled to be executed. But we begin this hour with the continuing efforts to put the Affordable Care Act back on track and a new report that the administration was never in position to go live on October 1st to begin with. According to newly released documents from House investigators, senior Obama administration officials, including several in the White House, were warned by the management consultant McKinsey that the effort to build healthcare.gov was falling behind and was at risk. The analysis had been requested by the White House, but the White House seemingly chose to ignore its findings. Senator Angus King is an independent from Maine. In the first month of open enrollment, fewer than 300 people in Maine signed up using the federal website. Senator King has long been a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but earlier he told me there is no excuse for the rollout to be as sloppy as it's been.
Execution is as important as vision. And in this case, I think the vision was the right one. I think the execution has not been adequate, but I think it's important to realize that the promise of this act, the key to it, is providing more available health care coverage to more people, and that's really important. There are varying estimates, but between 25 and 45,000 people a year die in the United States because they don't have insurance coverage, simply because they don't have insurance coverage. I think that's something that we ought to be doing something about. If all those people died in one town at one time, we'd be doing backflips to do something about it. And so the underlying premise of the law, I think, makes sense in the whole idea of the online marketplace. And it is complicated. I mean, if you go back and look at just at recent history, the rollout of the drug benefit under Medicare back in about, I think it was 2004, 2005. I can remember at the time there were headlines. It was just a disaster. The website didn't work. People couldn't figure it out. Seniors were confused and angry. So it's a big project. It's going to take some time, but they need to keep working to make it right. And ultimately, I think it is going to be helpful to a lot of people. I'm still a supporter of the law, but that doesn't mean I can't be critical of the way they've done the implementation thus far.
I want to move on to the budget, because that's another place where we've seen an inability of Congress to come together and reach consensus. We've just keep coming back to the brink and coming up with short-term patches. You've tried to lead a conversation out of that stalemate, but there doesn't seem to be much optimism in any corner in Washington that we're anywhere near any kind of long-term solution. When you look at it, I mean, the numbers just don't seem to be there politically, right? So how do you even start that conversation?
No, it's really hard. And let me share with you something. There was a graph I saw recently in one of the major newspapers that talked about the vanishing middle in the Congress. And in 1982, the space between the most liberal Republican and the most conservative Democrat included 344 members of Congress. The overlap, there were such a thing as moderate to liberal Republicans, there were conservative Democrats. Yeah, but the overlap was 344 members of Congress. Today, it's 11. And what that means is there's no center. Everybody's on one side or the other, and that's one of the things that makes these things so hard to settle. We can do things on the margin in less contentious issues, student loans, even immigration. We managed to put together a bipartisan group in the Senate. But when you get to the budget, it's really kind of the core of the religion of the two parties. You know, for the Republicans, it's no taxes, no new taxes, no new revenues, you know, the Grover Norquist pledge kind of stuff. And on the Democratic side, it's, you know, we can't do anything with entitlements. We've got to protect the entitlements. There can't be any revisions or changes. And the truth is, in my view, that both of those things is going to require new revenues and some work on entitlements, even if we just want to protect the entitlements for future generations. So, but that's what makes it so hard, because each side is defending their, you know, most sacred ground, and that's why we can't seem to get anywhere. But we have to. I mean, we haven't passed a budget in 4 years. It's the most basic function of government. And I think the other thing that people miss down here, they're so concerned about, you know, who's winning and losing. They don't really realize that everybody's losing because the public is disgusted with everybody.
Finally, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. President Lincoln talked about the great civil war our country was in the midst of and the question of whether a nation conceived in liberty can long endure. How do you view that message from President Lincoln today? Do you think it's appropriate or an overreach to compare Lincoln's message to the current climate in Washington?
Well, I don't want to over-dramatize it, but I do think that we're in a period where the functionality of the system the framers designed is being tested in ways that I can't ever recall. I ran into an old college history professor the other day and said, has there ever been a time in American history where government has been less functional and less able to address the nation's problems? And he said, of course. And I expected him to say the Civil War or something. He said, no, the Articles of Confederation, before the Constitution was drafted, which I thought was an interesting and somewhat scary insight, I do think we're at a time of extraordinary testing of whether our system can still serve the public's needs. Lincoln, you know, did an amazing thing at Gettysburg. That line, a nation conceived in liberty, which you mentioned, but then he went on to say, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That's not in the Constitution. Of course, it's mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, but that was a kind of turning point in American history about, you know, just what is this country all about. And I certainly think those words have as much power and validity today. And I think the underlying premise of the speech, which is this is an ongoing experiment. We've got to keep renewing the promise of America from generation to generation. And we can't just assume that because it worked for 100 years or 200 years or 47 years that it's going to continue to work. We have to continue to work at it and to make it function as it was designed by the framers and envisioned by everyone from starting with Jefferson through Madison and on through Abraham Lincoln. So we are still trying to build a more perfect union, and we're not there yet.
Angus King, independent senator from Maine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Delighted.
And as I mentioned, it's 150 years to the day since President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. Later this hour, does Lincoln's message to America still endure?
This is a speech that isn't just about 1863 or the 19th century or the Civil War. It's about the purposes and obligations of the American nation and American citizens.
We'll talk with Harvard University President Drew Gilpin Faust about Lincoln's message to the country and its meaning today. Add your voice, 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. To the Middle East, where dozens are reported dead after two bomb attacks close to the Iranian embassy in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. And it's thought Iran is being targeted for its support of the Lebanese Shia militant group Hezbollah. Hezbollah has sent fighters into neighboring Syria to back the government of Bashar al-Assad. Reports suggest one of the blasts was caused by a suicide bomber. The other was a car bomb. On the line with us is Anne Bernard, Beirut bureau chief of The New York Times. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
So this seems to fit a pattern of deepening political and sectarian divisions across the region inspired by this civil war in Syria. How does this attack fit into that context?
Well, ever since the Syrian insurgency began, both sides in Lebanon's politically divided world have participated on opposing sides in the Syrian war. Sunni militants have crossed the borders to fight with the rebels, and Hezbollah, which is the most powerful political organization here, as well as a militant group, has fought on the side of Bashar al-Assad more recently.
Who has taken responsibility for these bomb attacks today?
There's a claim of responsibility from a group called the Abdullah Azam Brigades, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda that operates in several countries, including Lebanon. But in many cases with these incidents, there are multiple claims of responsibility, so this is not confirmed yet.
And that offshoot of al-Qaeda, are they allied with the rebel fighters in Syria?
I don't know about the specific involvement of these brigades in Syria, but there are groups affiliated with al-Qaeda and others that espouse radical Sunni ideologies akin to al-Qaeda's that are fighting on the side of the rebels and increasingly clashing with rival rebel groups. So fear is that al-Qaeda is taking a greater role in the region, and Hezbollah justifies its involvement in Syria by saying that it's protecting Lebanon from these people.
So help us understand what these attacks in this part of Beirut means. I mean, this is on the Iranian embassy in Beirut. Is this a part of Beirut that had generally been considered safe? Is this a further escalation of the Syrian conflict spilling over into Lebanon?
It's definitely an area that up to now has been safe. It's a relatively well-to-do residential area. It has a number of embassies and organizations. It's a primarily Shiite area, but there are residents of all sects, and I think it's clear that the target was political in the sense that it was the Iranian embassy, and Iran is the main backer of Hezbollah and the main backer of Syria's government. So the assumption of people on the ground in the neighborhood was that they may have been targeted as Shiites because both Iran and Hezbollah are Shiite, but also that this was a statement to Iran about its support of President Assad.
The Iranian ambassador appeared on news channels blaming Israel for the blast. Israeli officials denied that. But does this complicate in the larger context U.S. involvement if these suicide bombers are suggesting that they are supportive of the rebel fighters in Syria?
Well, that's been the puzzle of the United States all along, and this is an endless debate. The rebels say that the reason that al-Qaeda has become ascendant within the insurgency is because of the lack of Western support for rebels who took up arms after the crushing of a political movement in Syria. On the other hand, the reason that the United States was reluctant to get involved from early on was the fear that the insurgency would grow more extremist and that rebel-held areas could become havens for al-Qaeda, or that any military aid going to them would end up in the hands of al-Qaeda.
Anne Bernard is the Beirut Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us on this busy day.
Thank you.
Anna Sale in for John Hockenberry. Later in the hour, we explore the history and meaning of the Gettysburg Address. President Lincoln gave the speech 150 years ago today, his vision for a more perfect union. Are we living up to those ideals?
Hi, this is Steve from Miami, Florida. The idea that slavery was abolished by Lincoln was a beautiful sentiment. The truth is that industrialization, real estate, and consolidated banking has put all Americans, not just African Americans, into the slavery of debt. Today, it is nearly impossible to climb the ladder of financial success.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When was the last time you took a selfie? An hour ago? A week ago? If you're asking what's a selfie, maybe the answer is never. Or maybe you know all about selfies, but God, you just can't bring yourself to say the word out loud. Selfie, a term for a self-portrait, usually snapped on the digital camera or smartphone with arm outstretched, is 2013's word of the year, according to Oxford Dictionaries. If you're cringing, stay with me. Though selfies have gotten a bad rap as the crowning achievement of a narcissistic, self-absorbed, self-obsessed youth culture, our guest points out young people didn't actually invent the selfie. Casey Sepp is a freelance writer from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. In a piece entitled In Praise of the Selfie in the magazine Pacific Standard, she argues that today's selfies spring off a long, rich tradition of self-portraiture. Welcome to The Takeaway, Casey.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna.
So talk us through this history. Who invented the selfie? Where did the word come from, and where did the idea of a selfie come from?
Sure. I mean, Oxford Dictionaries dates it to 2002, and they're talking about this purely abbreviated form selfie. But I think it's absolutely appropriate to connect it to the history of self-portraiture, which is an age-old human impulse. I mean, again, selfies, that word is a recent phenomenon, but the impulse to document ourselves and to give representation to our own appearance is something that's been around since the history of art. And in the essay that I wrote, I tried specifically to connect it to a tradition that was really transformed in the Renaissance, where suddenly you had all sorts of painters and artists striving to represent themselves and not only courtly subjects. So again, we're talking about a very, very long sweep of human history.
But let's talk about today's selfies, the ones that show up on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Why do you think they're worthy of cultural praise?
You know, I think we're living in an age of memoir and autobiography, and for me, selfies are the visual equivalent. So it seems to me that, again, if you think historically, there was a time in which the autobiographies of kings and queens and members of court were interesting, but the rest of us were told our lives didn't have the same significance. And if you apply that to visual art, again, we used to live in an age where only celebrities or heads of state merited portraiture. And now we're in an age where everyone feels like their life, their appearance, their embodiment in the world is worth documenting. And, you know, I think that is something we should celebrate.
And you make an interesting point in your piece about women and selfies in particular. You argue that they're empowering.
Absolutely. I mean, I think self-portraiture is certainly a genre in which women in particular have excelled. And I think, if you reflect on the history of art, for so long the male gaze fixed women on the canvas, the page, the screen, and then suddenly self-portraiture allowed women to challenge that gaze. You know, these were women who were not only artists, but they made themselves into subjects. And in the piece, I mentioned some of my favorite female self-portrait artists. And if you think of Cindy Sherman, Frida Kahlo, Nan Golden, these were all women who, you know, they didn't use the word selfie. They would have used the more formal self-portraiture. But these were women who were taking selfies and making selfies and using themselves as subjects for their work.
But isn't today's selfie where you put it up on Facebook and or Instagram and then watch kind of obsessively and compulsively to see who likes it and who comments on it? That doesn't feel like an empowering exercise.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think two things are different. I mean, it's certainly the case that technological innovation have made selfies not only easy and affordable, but also sort of infinite. So, you know, if you talk about someone like Frida Kahlo, she produced a certain number of portraits, but canvas and paint and time were all valuable and rare, and so there's a smaller number. Where today we're all able to produce, you know, if we wanted to, hundreds or thousands of selfies every single day. And I think you're right, too, that there's a sense that there's an obsession with the way in which they're received. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we don't think that someone like Cindy Sherman cares very much and obsesses over the kind of reception her work receives. So again, I think there's a way in which we can be unnecessarily critical of the amateur effort and fail to appreciate that the same anxieties and desires exist even for the rarefied artists whose work we espouse.
For me, I'm all about the selfie if it's a joint selfie, if it's like me and a friend or me and my boyfriend out and about. But the solo selfie, I've tried to do it. I tried when I voted to do a voter selfie. We were collecting voter selfies. And I was watching to see who was coming down the street to make sure I could take it with no one watching. I mean, there's something fundamentally embarrassing about it, don't you think?
I think there can be. So a couple of things. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the piece is the sense that a selfie is always about not only how you see yourselves, but you wish for other people to see you. And so, you know, not to psychologize you, Anna, but I would say it sounds to me like you're very interested in people knowing that you're not, you know, a solo hermit, that in fact you have friends, you have a partner.
I'm not alone in the world, people. Yeah.
Right. So that would be what I suspect is very important to you. Where, you know, for someone else, the importance might be, you know, I'm taking my own picture on the top of a mountain because it means I'm an adventurous person, or, you know, the person who takes his or her picture in front of the bookshelf, it doesn't matter that he or she lacks for friends. It matters only that, you know, he or she has an extraordinary library. So I think, you know, it's certainly the case that we will all have impulses we seek to honor in our selfies. For some people, the anxiety isn't social, but it's academic or it's cosmetic. And so what matters more than the number of friends who appear with you or the place in which you staged the photo is simply, you know, how your mascara looks or, you know, the quality of shirt you're wearing. So we're talking about different impulses for different people. I mean, I agree with you. To me, there is something more important in documenting the other people in my life. But I don't dismiss that for others, there's some more important impulse they're honoring.
And when was the last time that you selfied?
Well, you know, I think you guys are going to be putting them up on the websites. So I sent in two, one of which was that kind of self-constructed idea I was just talking about. And what I did was take my picture in front of books, because one of the things that matters most to me is the literature in my life. And so how else to document that but to stack the books literally around me? So it's not just me, but my books. And then in the spirit of the selfie, I took one right before this interview. So you'll see me sort of bleary-eyed and sleepy. And that's a more authentic, you know, what did I look like just before I got on the radio? Why is it better that we're on the radio and not on television? Well, you can see it in that selfie.
Casey Sepp, a writer from the Eastern Shore of Maryland and a proud defender of the selfie, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks again for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Anna Sale, in for John Hockenberry. Hundreds of thousands are still without power after a powerful storm system of tornadoes ripped through the Midwest on Sunday. The death toll stands at 8 people, and rescue workers are beginning to assess the full damage of the storm, which destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses. Joining us from Peoria Public Radio is Alex Rusciano. He's here to give us an update on the recovery efforts underway. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
So it's been about a day and a half since the storms hit. What do we know about the scale of the damage?
You know, there was at least one extremely powerful, likely an F4, an EF4 tornado that tore through Washington, Illinois. And estimates right now from officials are that anywhere from 250 to 400 homes were heavily damaged. And this tornado in the town of Washington tore up entire blocks, entire subdivisions were completely gone. I was walking around the streets yesterday of Washington, and it was very hard to tell what street you were on because there was so much debris, and there were just entire blocks, entire subdivisions were flattened.
Tell us about the town of Washington. What's it like? How many people live there, and what were you hearing from people while you were there?
Sure. I actually got in. Tornadoes and storms hit Sunday morning, and I was able to get in the town before law enforcement closed down large parts of the town, most of the town. And Washington is a town. It's about 10 to 15 miles northeast of Peoria in central Illinois. There's about 15,000 people who live there. And when I got into town, there were just hundreds of residents picking through the rubble of what remained of their homes. There were traffic was backed up for miles. There were people either trying to hitch rides so they can try and get into their subdivisions. And many residents, when I got there, were just in a state of shock. They were just trying to, I think, process as best as they could what happened in just a matter of moments.
And has the recovery started? What's the first step?
You know, that's a great question. As you mentioned, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn was in town yesterday, and really now begins the long process of recovery for the residents on a personal level. But state officials right now are in the process, probably from now until the end of the week, starting to do damage assessments. That's going to help the residents with insurance policies. It'll also help the state when they try and get federal money to help in recovery. Also, though, for specific residents day-to-day, the power companies here are trying to get as much power restored as they can. They're also looking to shut off gas lines because they don't want residents trying to recover or go into home if there's a live gas line. So really, it's just kind of a step-by-step basis. A step-by-step process to do property assessments and also work with the electrical companies.
And in the meantime, how many people are in temporary shelters at this point?
Yes, that's a good question. There were hundreds of people without homes after the tornado because it leveled anywhere as much as 400 homes in the area, heavily damaged. And so the Red Cross has actually been working with area churches, area groups to set up shelters. And so I stopped by one of the shelters late after the tornado the same day, and there were hundreds of people coming in.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there, Alex. Alex Rusciano is a reporter with Peoria Public Radio on the recovery efforts underway in Illinois after those storms tore through on Sunday. This is The Takeaway. The state of Missouri has a new protocol for executions put in place only last month, and it's about to be put into practice for the first time this week. On Wednesday, a man on death row is set to be executed via lethal injection with a drug called pentobarbital. It's commonly used to euthanize animals. But the manufacturer of pentobarbital doesn't want the drug to be used to kill humans, so the state is buying it from an unregulated compounding pharmacy. And we don't know which compounding pharmacy, because it's now illegal in Missouri to name the manufacturer, supplier, or compounding pharmacy that is selling the state the drug for executions. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says he supports these changes.
I mean, I looked at this from two perspectives. Number one was public safety, obviously, and the second was public health. On the public safety side, making sure that we continue to move forward with executions when folks have committed incredibly serious offenses like this, I think it's an important public policy matter that I continue to support.
Here to talk with us about this is political reporter Chris McDaniel, who's been reporting on this controversy for St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me on.
So just to start, I want to lay this out a bit. Where did the push come to protect the identities of manufacturers? Is this public policy concerns of drug companies?
Well, since none of these drug manufacturers want their products to be used for lethal injection, and that's true for propofol, and that's true for our new drug, pentobarbital. None of these manufacturers want their product to be used for a lethal injection. So they'll have their distributors sign a contract or at least agree to not selling it to departments of correction. So with the previous drug, propofol, it really begged the question of how Missouri got propofol at all, because departments of correction are not supposed to have it. But through a sunshine request originally started by the ACLU, we found out that the state of Missouri obtained it from someone who wasn't authorized to sell it by the manufacturer. That's when the governor came out and said that we were going to have to change our execution protocol. A week later, the Department of Corrections came back and had a new drug, but they also made a much more important change, which is that now it's illegal to name where the Department of Corrections is getting its drugs to execute people.
Are the safety standards for a drug intended to kill someone different than a drug intended to treat someone?
That's sort of a philosophical question that I can't really answer here. Certainly, it's important that the drug that we're going to be using for lethal injections is what we think it should be when we go through with it. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that when you're going through with it, if it's not up to standards, if let's say we go through with pentobarbital and it's not potent enough, then you would have a situation where this person could have suffering. It could last for a long time. Under the current execution protocol, they're supposed to inject him with the first syringe of pentobarbital, and then they're supposed to wait. And if it doesn't end up killing him throughout that set amount of time, then they're supposed to inject him with a new syringe of the same drug. Now, if both of those aren't strong enough to kill him because there's some problem with the drug that's made by a compounding pharmacy, you run the risk of them being brain dead. And then the state can't even execute them because they're not mentally capable.
So the source of this new drug, pentobarbital, the citizens of Missouri don't get to know where it's coming from. How does the state of Missouri know that it's safe if it's coming from one of these compounding pharmacies as opposed to a drug manufacturer?
Well, that's a really good question, because drug manufacturers, all of their products are regulated by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. That's not true with compounding pharmacies. Compounding pharmacies, their products are regulated by the individual states. So in Missouri, we have the Missouri Board of Pharmacy. They regulate compounding pharmacies. And for the past 10 years, within their regulations of compounding pharmacies, they found that about one out of every five drugs made by compounding pharmacies isn't up to their standards. It's unsatisfactory.
So this execution of Joseph Paul Franklin is scheduled for Wednesday. Is there any thinking that the available sourcing of a drug for lethal executions, could that change the schedule for Wednesday or for future executions in Missouri?
Well, the legal team for Joseph Paul Franklin and some other inmates who are on death row have certainly appealed, saying that they've changed the rules a month out from the execution. They need more time to come up with a legal defense. They have problems with drugs coming from a compounding pharmacy since they aren't regulated by the FDA. So far, the Missouri State Supreme Court, they've denied all of their appeals for a stay of execution.
Chris McDaniel, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Complicated stuff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Anna Sale, in for John Hockenberry.
Hey, I got a non-emergency. My terminally sick mom, I just found her dead.
It's a story where we know the ending from the very beginning. A daughter calling 911 to report that her mother has died. What happened leading up to that moment is the subject of a new show called Time of Death. It's a Showtime series following eight people as they succumb to terminal diseases, making visible their most painful moments and how they and their loved ones confront the coming end.
I cry easily. I cry all the time. If I touch him or I see him take a breath, it's like I want to tell him, take that next breath, you know? Even though I know it's better for him not to take that next breath at this time because he's been through so much. But it's hard to let go.
A voice from a mother profiled in this series. Creator and co-executive producer Miggy Hood conceived of the show at the time of the death of her own mother. Though Hood was always close with her mother, her siblings were not. In fact, they hadn't spoken in years or all gathered together until the final days of her mother's life.
They didn't have any contact whatsoever for about 25 years, one of them 18 years, another in 7 or 8. And I looked after her, but from far away, from L.A., and she was living in London. And so I went over there when she went into the hospital and realized very quickly that she was nearing the end. So I called them in. They didn't actually respond initially because they didn't really believe it. But when they did finally show up, the timing was sort of extraordinary, because she had just had this massive seizure, and I thought she had died. So they arrived at that moment, and we were sort of gathered around the bed. And at that point, her eyes opened, and she saw these children that she hadn't seen for so many years. It was great. She was happy to see them. So they had a reconciliation, and after she died, I just sort of began dwelling on the fact that there's still this kind of disconnect that people have about acknowledging that life is short and we need to pay attention to our relationships.
I want to talk about Maria and her children. Maria is a character we meet very early on. She's a 25-year-old daughter as well as a teenage son and another teenage daughter. And their relationship, the 25-year-old Nicole and Maria, the mother, is so striking because you are showing that not only is acceptance and denial and figuring out what that dance will be like when you know that someone you love is going to die. It shows that, but also it shows you capture on film the way she's withholding medical information from her children.
Yeah.
So you're seeing that she's trying to protect them. And it leads finally to a moment where Maria tells her daughter that she's scared. Let's take a listen.
I thought I'd tell you I'm scared. For the first time, I'm, like, really scared this time. Before, I shrugged it off.
Yeah.
And thought, oh, we'll get it under control. Oh, the next drug will be the key.
Yeah.
So
sorry, Mom.
I know. It spread like wildfire, and now it's here, and now I'm losing hope. So for the first time, I'm actually really scared and really sad.
And that's the first moment you really see Maria, the mother, turn to her daughter and say, I don't know what to do here.
It's a powerful moment. It gave me goosebumps just listening to it. Honesty. I mean, that's a huge issue in human relationships. You see Nicole and the kids get upset that she's not honest. I mean, the son says it pisses him off that his mother won't tell him what's going on. And she thinks that the best thing as a mother is to keep it to herself. My opinion is that honesty is a hugely important issue with families because it's clearly better when Maria is open, but she can't bring herself to do that until she's really made very vulnerable by the process, by the medication, by the reality. I mean, she comes completely undone and comes back together again.
So we're halfway through this series at this point. Three episodes have run. There are three more episodes to go. Has anything about the audience reaction so far surprised you?
No, I think that people fall into two categories, people who want to watch the show and people who don't want to watch the show. And I think actually the people who don't want to watch the show, oftentimes they have personal experiences that are too close and too visceral and too immediate for them to separate enough to be able to watch the show objectively. I would say that it's quite cathartic for those people I know who have had personal experiences. And I mean, who of us hasn't really? It can be very, very good to see things that are familiar and to know that there are other people out there who have gone through or are going through something that you've gone through. So I think there's a comfort in that because nobody participated in this who didn't want to do it. So
were you aware of that as a filmmaker, as you're capturing these stories of the final months, weeks, days? I mean, that is an added responsibility beyond what any documentary filmmaker usually. You are
very
writing.
Aware. Very, very aware. And there was a huge amount of sensitivity involved in how we entered into these people's lives. And you'll see many scenes in the show where doors are closed and people say, I don't want to be filmed right now. And that was respected absolutely, unequivocally.
And I'm curious, having made this show, Time of Death, having looked so closely at death, do you find yourself thinking more about the end of your own life, or is it...
Yes. I have to say, yeah. And reliving the experience of my mother dying and thinking about her life. Yeah, definitely. It's a double-edged sword, honestly. And I think, obviously, that is why people, generally speaking, don't want to think about it, don't want to think about death, because it's, it's not fun. And it's quite a bizarre concept, really, that we are all going to die. But I hope that by giving it a nod, that we will pay more attention in life.
Miggy Hood is the creator and co-executive producer for Showtime's new series, Time of Death. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Next up on The Takeaway, the Gettysburg Address. Today is the 150th anniversary of that famous speech. But what about the next 150 years? What work still remains to build a more perfect union? Ricky Vassallo in Clearwater, Florida, says we need to fix the judicial system. Too many inmates rather be incarcerated in real life, too much of a load on the working man. Give us your take. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. And there's more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation.
Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure.
The voices of former Presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, collected by documentarian Ken Burns on this 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. They're words so many of us learned as school children that established certain ideals for our union, a place where all men are created equal, a union that can long endure, a promise that those who fight and died to save the union shall not have died in vain, and their efforts shall have a new birth of freedom. But in 2013, are we a nation living up to these values? Drew Gilpin-Faust is the president of Harvard University, a historian, and author of This Republic of Suffering, Death and the American Civil War. As she explains, the Gettysburg Address is more than a speech about the cost of a war. It's also a nod to a greater project the war was in service of.
He wants to tie the terrible loss and suffering that Gettysburg represented and that the war had represented up to that point. And he wants to take that loss and say, what does it mean? How can we somehow make this cost have a benefit? And so it's first about the project of finishing the war, of making sure that the work that these soldiers started is accomplished. But then he redefines that work. It's not simply the war itself. It's not going to be over when the war is won. Instead, it's this projection into the future of a dedication to a new birth of freedom, to a nation that is conceived in liberty and dedicated to a proposition, understood in a new way. So it's a project for all of us, as well as for those of the Civil War era.
I want to pause for just a minute on the moment where we are in the Civil War when President Lincoln delivers this speech.
Lincoln has had a hard time up to 1863. He has witnessed a lot of Southern victories. And so Lincoln is at a moment where he is being challenged, in a sense, to deliver, because time, in a sense, is running out for him. He's going to have to run for re-election in a year. He worries that the North will give up. So that is what the Battle of Gettysburg gave him, was a victory, an ability to begin to think more hopefully about how the war might turn out. And so now he's going to turn hope into dedicate, resolve. Those uses of shall, three uses of shall at the end of the address itself. It's about winning the war. It's about having a new birth of freedom. It's about making sure that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish. And those are the instructions, the imperatives that are inherent in this address, well beyond the kind of abstraction of a hope. He's now ready for a resolve.
So that's the immediate political moment. And you mentioned those uses of the word shall, this look beyond the immediate moment, looking forward, using the future tense. But he also seems to have such a sense of legacy as he's talking, as he's delivering this short address, talking about never forget what they did, talking about the ground being consecrated, this real look to an audience what feels like 150 years on.
That's caught up in part, I believe, with the Christian framework of this message, in that it's very powerfully about resurrecting the dead, about the immortality of a nation that is delivered through death. All of these are very Christian images.
So President Lincoln was speaking more to the thoughts of eternity and to this Christian Protestant audience of the time, not necessarily to us 150 years on looking at our government in Washington. But I wonder, as you read this, what does it make you think about in terms of our political system and our relationship now as citizens?
The Gettysburg Address, in my view, is in considerable part a challenge to the people of his time to carry out the unfinished work. And it's an immortal speech because it challenges all of us to make sure that everything that has been done to create this country, from the efforts of our forefathers that he refers to at the very beginning of the address, to the contributions of the soldiers he is honoring, all of those things have been contributed to give us what we have been left as the legacy of this country. And so it's now our responsibility to take up that work and give it to our descendants and our grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
And what do you think, 150 years on, reading it, do you feel like we're stepping up or that we're letting Lincoln down?
Well, we've just seen the government shut down over its inability to agree. I also worry about statistics showing increasing American inequality. I also think, in terms of the new birth of freedom, he was speaking here about emancipation, about the project of African-American freedom. That is a project that played out over a very long period of time after the Civil War. And there's still much to be addressed here.
So I hear you articulating some ways to take up some unfinished work.
Yes, unfinished work.
Drew Gilpin-Faust is a historian and the president of Harvard University. Thanks so much for joining us, President Faust.
Thank you.
And all this hour, we're collecting your comments on the Gettysburg Address. Do you think we're living up to its ideals? From one of you in Athens, Ohio, we need to stop caring about parties. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. What matters is your ideals, values, and what you strive to achieve. Lately, it seems as though it's a matter of one party against the other rather than everyone working to achieve what is best for the American people. And we'll leave you with the full Gettysburg Address. We all know the first few lines, hear them all the time, but the whole thing is worth pausing and taking a listen to. This version was recited in 1986 by Gregory Peck.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
I'm Anna Sale in for John Hockenberry. John's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.